Now, for four decades, Stanley Kubrick made some of the most memorable films in movie history. Dr. Strangelove, Clockwork Orange, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Shining, just a few. Any one of those would have put a director in an important spot in movie history. The legendary filmmaker died in 1999, shortly after finishing his final film, Eyes Wide Shut. Though he's been gone for 20 years, his films have endured and likely will for years to come, and now he's the subject of a new biography that looks at his life, his work, and his legacy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a film fan, what are some of your favorite Kubrick films? What have they meant to you? And do you have movies like 2001 or Dr. Strangelove or some of the others on your list of all-time favorites that you recommend or come back to? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. David Mikkix is the Moores Professor of Honors and English at the University of Houston. He's the author of several books. His latest is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks, Rob. Very happy to be here again and happy to talk about Kubrick.
Now, I think a lot of us have probably had that moment where we're watching a bad movie and thinking, I don't know anything about making movies, but I could do a better job than that. Well, cleaning up the language a little bit, Stanley Kubrick had that thought, only it was true for him. Can you talk about how he went from a photographer to a movie maker from that moment?
Indeed, yes. Kubrick had a very interesting, almost a unique career among major filmmakers. He taught himself how to make movies. As you mentioned, he was originally a still photographer. Straight out of high school, he got a job with Look magazine, one of the two major photography feature magazines in America. And but, you know, he'd been a movie addict since high school, you know, constantly skipping out on school to see double features. And friends reported that he would sit in the seats when he got bored. He would read the newspaper and mutter, as you said, yeah, I could do better than that. So he read a few books on movie making. He borrowed some money from an uncle. And soon he made his first short newsreel about a boxer and then his first feature.
And looking through his career, his movies were different genres. They look different. They feel different. Is there something you could say, this is a consistent theme, a consistent element that really distinguishes a Stanley Kubrick movie?
You know, Rob, that's one of the most fascinating things about Kubrick. And, you know, I had so much fun writing this book, trying to tease out the relationships among these movies, which, as you say, at first seem so different. And yet they all are very interconnected. You know, in a Kubrick movie, you have an elaborately programmed world, usually, that controls the people in it. And there's a concern with melding human behavior, you know, with turning people into, you know, into functions somehow. And, you know, so we see this in 2001 in Full Metal Jacket, in The Shining, and a number of the other movies. And I think in his final movie, Eyes Wide Shut, Kubrick attempts something different. He was, you know, a filmmaker who was concerned with marriage, although people don't often think of him in this way. He made three great movies about marriage, Barry Lyndon, The Shining, and Eyes Wide Shut. And in Eyes Wide Shut, at the end, we get a kind of a freedom, a release from these claustrophobic, horrible marriages that we see in the earlier movies. So there are themes that link these movies together, for sure.
Well, I'm going to throw a bunch of different individual titles at you as we go on, but let's start with the caller doing that at 800-642-1234. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very pleased that you mentioned Barry Lyndon, because it's an excellent adaptation of Thackeray's novel. And it's at that time, in 1975, I was in film school myself, and I told people I thought it was his greatest film to date. And I see now on the internet that there are others arguing the same thing. There were cameras from NASA that they used to film some of the candlelit scenes that are just amazing. He was such an artist.
Tom, thanks so much for that call and for getting us started. David, I got to admit, I'm about 50-50 on Stanley Kubrick films that I've seen. Mm-hmm. Barry Lyndon, one that I haven't seen. Introduce us to it a little more.
Okay, well, as Tom said, it's a very elaborate and sumptuous movie. Tom mentioned the Zeiss cameras that were developed by NASA. This is what enabled Kubrick to use candlelight in the movie. He insisted that all scenes had to be naturally lit. It's a movie set in the 18th century. So, of course, you had to use candlelight. And since Kubrick demanded take after take, the art director, Ken Adam, who actually had a nervous breakdown, you know, he had to leave the movie. Ken Adam was just driven crazy by this because with every take, the candles had to be burned down to exactly the right setting, exactly the right height. It's a very painterly movie. It's, you know, very lovely. It's very slow moving. It's sort of the antithesis of those sort of slapdash, you know, verve-filled 70s movies that we think of, including a movie like Clockwork Orange, which he had made just before. So it really anticipates the taste for the historical romance or the historical epic that we see a few years later with all the Jane Austen adaptations, for example. But it's a very lovely movie.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. We are talking to David Mikics about his book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have thoughts on any of his movies, questions, maybe a fond memory of the next one we'll talk about. We're going to jump around the timeline here. Dr. Strangelove, and I want to give a listen to setting it up here. We're on the brink of nuclear war, and here's the character, the title character, Peter Sellers, as Dr. Strangelove, laying out maybe the upside for the generals and bureaucrats he's talking to. Here's a listen.
I would guess that dwelling space for several hundred thousand of our people could easily be provided.
Well, I would hate to have to decide who stays up and who goes down.
Well, that would not be necessary, Mr. President. Could easily be accomplished with a computer. And the computer could be set and programmed to accept factors from youth, health, sexual fertility, intelligence, and a cross-section of necessary skills. Of course, it would be absolutely vital that our top government and military men be included to foster and impart the required principles of leadership and tradition.
Also, Peter Sellers as the president there, and the military leaders that he was talking about looking on. Maybe this isn't such a bad idea. David, talk about this absurd movie about the very real fear and risk of nuclear oblivion.
Yeah, it's quite a movie and it's quite a concept. Kubrick, ever since the Berlin crisis at the beginning of the 60s, had become obsessed with the danger of nuclear war. And he even got to know one of the major theorists at the RAND Corporation, a guy named Herman Kahn, who liked to speculate about the consequences of nuclear war. And, you know, we have to take it as a practical possibility. Maybe the war will happen. And then what will we do? So all of this stuff about mega deaths and, you know, how many millions would die in a nuclear exchange, you know, all of that comes from real nuclear theorists, of course. But what Kubrick did, and this is the really radical thing about the movie, is he played this as a wild satire, you know, with this Rabelaisian, totally extravagant vision of nuclear war. And a lot of people were taken aback by this at the time. I mean, the movie was a huge hit. But there were various reviews that said, oh, how dare he, you know, how dare he take such a sober subject, you know, such a solemn subject and play it for laughs. But what he was doing was showing us the absurdity of it, you know, the craziness of it. And that was the only way to get that across. And then we have the remarkable set, the War Room, designed by Ken Adam, who I mentioned, who later worked on Barry Lyndon, you know, one of the greatest sets in movie history.
Something I always remember about that movie, and it probably says something about Kubrick's storytelling ability, that, you know, when you're in the American bomber with Slim Pickens, like you're almost rooting for these guys to pull through and accomplish their mission, and then like, wait a minute, if they do that, everybody in the world dies.
Yes, that is that's great. And there's that great moment when George C. Scott is talking about how the plane is going to get through, and he's very excited by this, as if, you know, he's really rooting for them. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Hi. Me being a veteran, I mean, just seeing Full Metal Jacket, I mean, the realism that he portrayed in that, I mean, just seeing the war zones and the training and everything, I mean, it was just so graphically real. I mean, you almost felt like you were there, you know. It was surreal, you know.
Tony, thank you so much for sharing that thought. David, Full Metal Jacket, I think based, you write, on memoirs of a veteran's experience from Vietnam. Talk about how Tony, a veteran, could have that, it's like you were there feeling.
Yeah, exactly. The movie was based on a book by Gus Hasford, who had been in Vietnam. It's a book called The Short Timers, which is now out of print, but quite a good book. And, you know, Hasford was quite a character. You know, I don't have time to get into his life, but, you know, very extravagant kind of roughneck type and, you know, but very funny and wickedly smart. And so Kubrick, along with Michael Herr, who had, you know, Herr was in combat as well and wrote one of the best books about Vietnam War called Dispatches. So they set out to make a movie, which again has an aspect of absurdity, just like Strangelove, that the scene at the beginning, you know, it's the great drill instructor, Sergeant Hartman, played by Lee Ermey, who had actually been a drill instructor. I mean, it's crazy, it's absurd, but as Tony was saying in his call, it also feels very real. You know, that kind of humiliation and that kind of training were actually did and does, I think, take place in the Marines. But also we have in the movie the sense of, you know, there's a certain shapelessness as we go on. The men get lost. You know, the squad doesn't know what to do next. And, you know, it mirrors the actual situation of America in Vietnam. It's like, why are we there? What are we doing there? Nobody really seems to know. And we have the main character, Joker, I'm not going to give away the ending of the movie, which is tremendous, so no spoilers, but, you know, he faces a crisis, a real test at the end, and you can see all the ambivalence in his face as he, you know, as he goes through the final moments of the movie.
Thanks for that call, Tony. We're talking to David Mikic about his new book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. He's a professor at the University of Houston. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your experiences watching Kubrick movies. If you want to nominate a favorite, do you have thoughts on The Shining, A Clockwork Orange, or 2001? We're going to get to in just a minute. Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's a bit of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, featured prominently in Stanley Kubrick's 1971 film, A Clockwork Orange. We're talking to David Mikic. He wrote a book, Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker. We're talking about Kubrick's career and movies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Peter with us next in Milwaukee. Peter, hi.
Hello. What a fascinating topic for one of the filmmakers that definitely occupies the top of Mount Olympus. I was curious, though, in your book, do you address the fact that Stanley Kubrick's vision, he did not want to compromise by having to work with the Hollywood studio system, and in order to absolutely execute his singular vision, which, again, his work is outstanding. But is it true that he did finance his own films in order to keep Hollywood from messing up his vision? And was there a specific instance that led him to that conclusion? Thank you.
Oh, great, great, great question. Thank you. Well, as I said, his first movie, his first feature was, you know, financed by a relative, his uncle. But as he went on, of course, he entered the Hollywood studio system. After Dr. Strangelove, which was such a massive hit, Kubrick really felt empowered to demand complete artistic control. In fact, he scribbled a note on a contract that was being offered to him by Columbia Pictures. And the note said that I demand complete, total, final, annihilating artistic control over the picture. So at any rate, that tells you something. But yeah, it was in part his experience on Spartacus. Now, this was his first big hit, Spartacus, which he took over from another director, Anthony Mann, at the request of Kirk Douglas, the star. The movie came out in 1960, but Kubrick had no control over the script. And he said, you know, I kept telling Kirk, this is dumb, the script, well, this has to be changed. And Kirk would agree with me, and then nothing would get changed. And so Kubrick was very disappointed in that experience. So when he went on to make Lolita and then Dr. Strangelove, he did have complete control over those movies. Now, later in his career, it was really because his movies were made with relatively small crews and were relatively cheap that he was able to have such control. Warner Brothers executives, his final movies were all from Warner Brothers, from Clockwork Orange on. And the Warner Brothers executives, guys like John Calley and Terry Semel, were very happy to work with Kubrick. And of course, Kubrick worked at a very slow pace. You know, he did not turn out a movie every year or every other year. But, you know, what he did relatively inexpensively. And so they were happy to go along with it. They knew he was a genius. They knew he was a great director.
Thanks for that call, Peter. We'll go to Brian now in Ashland. Brian, hi.
Hi, Rob. So I became a pretty huge Kubrick fan when I was at the UW studying film, and later became a historian and find myself turning to his films to sort of supplement what we've been talking about. Some of the films you talked about, like Full Metal Jacket on the Vietnam War, Dr. Strangelove on the absurdity of the Cold War. But one of the films that I seemed to show all the time for World War One was Paths of Glory, which I've not heard mentioned, but is one of his early films and one of the most, I would say, damning anti-war pictures ever made, which also stars Kirk Douglas and probably started their relationship.
Mm-hmm. Brian, thanks a lot for that call. Talk about, I guess, the lasting influence of Kubrick and how people could use him to illustrate not just film history, but history, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Paths of Glory is a great instance. I mean, it's a very, although, you know, Kubrick actually made the trenches wider than they were, you know, so that the camera that he wanted could get through the trench. But by and large, it's a very accurate film, and it depicts a great scandal in French military history, in which a group of generals decide to have some men executed for symbolic reasons. So the movie was actually banned in France for decades. And, you know, despite Kirk Douglas's enthusiasm, Kubrick had a hard time getting a studio to take it on. It came out from United Artists. But the idea was that, well, you know, the French are going to ban it. And anyway, war movies are death at the box office. This is 1957, and there have been several big flops in the war movie genre just before that. But it is it does give you a remarkable feel for World War One combat when Douglas is crawling through no man's land, and there's a tremendous score by Gerald Fried, who was a high school buddy of Kubrick's. It's all percussion. And, you know, you see him, he's being filmed by a handheld camera, you know, just crawling slowly with these bombs bursting around him. And these are real explosions, too. It's not the usual shower of dirt that you get in a war movie. But Kubrick, Kubrick made sure that you get actual pieces of metal flying through the air. So, yeah, there's a lot of very precise, obsessive detail that, adds to the historical accuracy in this instance.
Thanks a lot for that call. I'm going to end giving you a one-minute challenge, David. A friend of mine watched 2001, your favorite, recently, and said, you know, with our fast-paced entertainment now, it felt slow watching it. Make the case that we should retune ourselves to that pace and re-watch or watch for the first time 2001.
Oh, you should. You should so much. Well, you know, there's a challenge here, of course, because now, not only during COVID, but even before that, we tend to watch movies at home. And 2001 especially seems to demand a big screen. You know, it's just sort of you get immersed in it. It surrounds you. It's a whole world. It's a whole universe. And, you know, if you're just sort of watching a bit and then making dinner and going back to it, you know, you lose that feeling. So I would say sit down, watch it. You know, if you have a big screen at home, that's perfect. And just give yourself over to it. Just surrender to it. Forget about time. My 10-year-old did it. My 10-year-old boy is actually a big fan of 2001. And so it can be done and it should be done. Yeah, I love it. The first really speculative movie made by Hollywood where you had to wonder, what does this all mean? What about that ending? And it was one of MGM's 10 biggest moneymakers, you know, a complete success.
That's a great place to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Rob.
I've been talking to David Mikics. His new book is Stanley Kubrick, American Filmmaker.